just my talk, which was scheduled after the break, will be right now. It's about NaviServer, it's about scalability. What will this talk cover? I mean, is something also a short introduction of NaviServer as a summary. I will talk about a little bit about scalability. NaviServer and IOL server are known to be very scalable, but you can never be enough scalable. There's always a limit you will hit, and I will address here a classical problem that you have, a multi-core CPU, and we have more and more cores available, and it might happen that you're not able to use all of these cores because, for whatever reason, but the system is getting slow, and one often reason is locking, in-memory locking. You have a multi-threaded program, and you have shared resources, and these shared resources will be used for multiple places, and only one resource, one thread, can be at one time active on this memory region. Therefore, you need locks, and I will address this kind of problem. You have this shared resource in the middle, you have multiple threads which are trying to access this, and if this memory location is blocked from another one, the other ones have to wait. And if you have more and more and more and more threads, the likelihood that it will happen goes up and can pile up, as we see later. And I mean, another thing which became important the last couple of years is more strict input handling, which means invalid input of all kinds. All kinds means also invalid UTF-8. Many of these problems were triggered by vulnerability scans we are doing regularly with a system called Aquanetics, and it tries to inject at every possible place some fancy values which are used there for trying to do some SQL injection or do some kind of JavaScript injection or simply break other kind of barriers by using different kind of, let's say, UTF-8 sequences, which are somewhat equivalent. I mean, it's a long story of thinking, but it is needed in real time, real life applications, because the number of threads is going up, and there will be also a couple of other, let's say, things which are happening, and also we'll cover a little bit about NaviServer and HTTP2. I mean, to make it short, the history of NaviServer started in the early 1990s as a closed source product developed by a company called Navisoft, and this product was done for company AOL, America Online, and was afterwards used as a so-called AOL server, which was in 1999 was published as open source from AOL at this time. And over the years, I mean, AOL was very protective about what's going on there, and they didn't want the community to change what they are using. And there were many other requirements popping up. And one of the requirements we had there very strong was, let's say, the move from a pure HTTP server into a multi-protocol server, just to support many protocols at the same time. What this means is also UDP, SMTP, LDAP, DNS, CoAP. These are implemented as various modules that you can add at any time, and it was not interesting for the AOL people at all to include this. Therefore, it was some kind of a, let's say, friendly fork with different intentions where to go. And also there were a couple of big steps also, like we heard about integrating IPv6, whatever it was happening there as well over the last years. And there's a very strong now integration with OpenSSL up to whatever, version 3, newest version. And integrating OpenSSL doesn't mean only to be able to use TLS, under quotes, but it also opens a wide range of crypto facilities. I mean, there's many, you can sign things, you have elliptic curves there, and you have an TCL API for accessing the parts that we needed most. I mean, it's an open-ended interface as possible, but it also gives you various message digests or HMAX, and you can choose from a long list of different digest mechanisms which are maintained by OpenSSL, and we have there, I think, more than 20 different digesters can be used at various places. It's a pluggable system and quite important. And from the source code size, it's much less code than OpenSSL, and it's mostly C code. It is a little bit tickle code, and but most of it is actually C code. A good part of the tickle code is for the regression test, which is also quite good, I think. I mean, there's also about code history. I mean, again, this code age analysis. I mean, what does it do? I mean, it looks more or less that for every single line of the current version, when was this line changed the last time? And there are lines which were coming from the year 2000, which has not been touched until today, and there are lines which are changed over the time. And by this, if you have all of the lines, you can compute afterwards the average age of the code. If you look at one file, it might have different ages in different lines, but whatever. And what you see here also in the way that typically when things start going on, then there was this fork there. The old history is here from AOL server. You see it was very conservative on changing things, and there was this big start of the AOL server. Many things were refactored and done differently, and also for some other, let's say, releases, things changed, and I think this 9.499.14 was this integration of OpenSSL happening and so on. I mean, also the average code age is about 10 years. I just made during the last presentation here a count. It was, we have about, if we do the same statistics on tickle, the average code age on tickle is about 15 years. I mean, therefore, there's more things changing, going on, and Navi servers typically, whatever, 2 to 4 releases per year. I mean, the last year was 2 releases, and there's always a reasons for not releasing things right yet. And I mean, one of the reasons was we talked yesterday about UTF-8, and I mean, the actual release is much more strict on accepting input and was rejecting in many places invalid UTF-8, but immediately people complained and say, now this thing broke my release. I know we have invalid UTF-8, but what should we do? I mean, if the system always raises exception, we have to rewrite everything. It's impossible. Therefore, one thing has to do something. And was one of the changes was there introducing the so-called fallback character sets. I mean, you can. If a request comes in and by default you get a reject, but a site administrator can say, okay, please make another attempt with another character set. Even if it's false, just make a fallback to ISO character set or something which is not a problem. And people are very happy with this. I mean, if they are happy, I'm happy. I mean, they don't blame me with bug reports. And it's also, I mean, at the end, this incoming thing is also at the end afterwards converted to UTF-8, and they're also happy because they have better data now. I'm coming now a little bit to this mutex stuff and just look back from the times of OpenSSL 5.9.0 in 2019. And it was very scalable systems there, but I mean, also what's good in the Navi servers, you have many statistics of what's happening internally. And there's a program called NSTATS, it's a tickle file, where you get many of the internal values, how does something behave. And what you see here is about locks in memory, and what are the timing from these locks, and how often these locks occur, and how many lock attempts are busy locks, where the server has to wait. And based on these statistics, afterwards, you can make clever decision how to improve the performance altogether. And what we see here is, I mean, from a running system here, it was since the start of the sim, it has 1.8 gigalocks. So a billion locks in English. But what's interesting here is for a single request you get there, you have there, for example, 700 mutex locks for a single request. And you should know that we have often in the range of 200, 400 requests per second. We have to multiply this. And every of these locks can bring the whole system to a waiting state. All threads are blocked by this lock. Therefore, getting awareness about this kind of locking, why is not a thing so parallel as it should be? We have so many threads, why are the threads not active? One of the problems there is look at locking here. And you can also, from this average locking times, you can afterwards calculate how many requests you can make hypothetically with your current setup in your current situation. And these locks are coming from various places. They're coming from caches where cache values have to be read out, and at the time you're reading out this value, you have to lock it, typically a very short time. But in some cases, from the application program, you can lock this cache for a long time. I mean, if you have a cache with 300,000 entries, which is normal, and you iterate over all of these entries, what happens there is it's producing from the cache keys a tickle list of 300,000 elements and performing afterwards maybe a match operation on all of these, and then it unlocks it. It takes a time. I mean, it's fast, but whatever fast means, if it takes a couple of milliseconds, it's horrible because the server stops afterwards. And I mean, we do our streaming, live streaming is over the thing, and if there are a couple of milliseconds for one lock, then other things pile up and it really becomes not usable, and our streams would stop in the classrooms, whatever, if this happens. Therefore, it is something which is certainly important to come up with this, and I mean, you can get there many detailed statistics from this. And there are some kind of, let's say, hot caches. You can figure out where the most, whatever, hits per request if on the caches side there. And for caches, what we're doing is, I've mentioned it the last time, a little bit about cache partitioning. I mean, if you are able to partition a single cache into multiple caches, you have multiple locks, therefore less waiting times and less contention on a single lock. It speeds up things, and therefore it's making things easier. And what you see also there is that the saved amount of time per lock, which or per cache entry, you get here something up to 76 milliseconds on average, which you save by caching. Caching is very important. I mean, many of the requests we have 50, 100, or sometimes 200 SQL queries behind this. If you want to get scalability, there's no way that you send everything to SQL and hope it gets back in time. It has to be cached, and the cache needs high, a good throughput. And therefore, I mean, this time is calculated by, you know, when you store the cache value, what was the timing of the thing? This is afterwards the time which was external time, and you can compare it to the cache lock time, and by this you can compare this save time at the end. And having these statistics really helps to tune the system and get good performance out of this. And many of the things happened also in the OpenACS kernel. And if you use OpenACS, you don't have to go to the details. Normally, everything works better, but sometimes it requires something like this. And having good cache entries is something where the question is, what good is this? One cache, which is a classical good old cache from OpenACS, where everything is more or less stored there. And you see some of the entries are very often reused. Here's the hits means the reuse time of the cache entry. And getting here high reuse is on one side good, other side bad. It's good because you save a lot of time. But at the same time, if every request reads often this entry, it's a good sign that maybe you should put some load from this cache away, because if it's simply a cache which has a single value, you can't do better. But normally, there are 100,000 of other entries there, which are also under the same cache competition. It's also an indicator that you should think about redoing it. And just by going here back, I mean, the current OpenACS 5.10 had reduced these numbers from 700 to 248 locks. I mean, it's just times three. And therefore, we have more and more cores. It means scalability simply goes up. I don't go through all the details, but if you're interested, we can do many times here. And here's what I said before. How is this caching times happening? I mean, there's a thing called NSCache names. Give me all of the keys, and this might be several hundred thousand entries, and you're getting large lists, and you have to process this. And there's a thing about flush patterns. You have a match pattern on entries, and using this kind of operation is a no-no. We should try to avoid it if it comes to scalability. Or you can do like smaller caches. I mean, if not everything is put in one cache, but if multiple caches, there's less afterwards. If you need forever this pattern matching there for the cache entries, don't retrieve everything that's not necessary. Try to reduce the thing you retrieve from this cache by the keys, just the relevant ones. And this is about cache partitioning, and therefore it's just what I mentioned before. Another important thing which came up over the years is that most of in OpenSS is based on database, and database has transactions, and transactions which are happening might not always succeed. Sometimes they're rolled back. But if you have a database transaction, and in this database transaction, you have some API calls, and these API calls you have there will cache values into this cache we said before. I mean, you call something, it's cached, you call something, it's cached, fine. But for whatever reason, this transaction fails. For the database, it's fine, it's doing a rollback. But what happens with the values in memory? They will be wrong, because who tells the cache that these entries, which are rolled back to the database, which are newer values already, are incorrect. Therefore, it's a problem to getting the cache consistent with rollbacks in the database is some kind of a challenge. And there's always a question about isolation at the end, if you look in detail, because database isolation say other running threads should not see what happens. It should look from a consistent state to another consistent state, but if your cache is updated there, the other threads can see also your cache entries. It's also bad. And what to do there is certainly you can implement something, and this is the so-called cache transaction, and it's article calls which say, now I'm inside a transaction. This transaction can be nested in OpenSS, and also this NSCache transaction begin can be nested. And at the end of this operation, you do a commit. You make it afterwards visible to everybody and accessible to everybody, or at the end, a rollback. Nobody sees it, and it is reset. The consequences, I mean, the first thing is these are errors which are very hard to debug. You have a large system. I mean, if you have a simple system, you never see it. It's always fine. But if a system with several thousand users at the same time doing things around and many fails, you have no idea why you are getting now this value. And some of these problems were coming from this, actually, transaction mechanism. And also the statistics show you here for the number of rollbacks which happen in the system, but don't happen too often. But it's certainly important to keep the cache consistent with the things which are in the database. Coming back to the thing with the mutex locks. I mean, it shows here a little bit the problem there. It's not a problem that you have a resource which is locked, have to wait, but things pile up. You have here multiple threads, and they're doing something. And when the thread starts here, it does here a lock, it does its operation, and it releases something. But if in the meantime another thread comes up and wants to do the same thing on the resource, it has to wait until the first transaction, the first operation inside the lock ends, and therefore there's a waiting time. And this waiting time, if more and more threads are coming, is piling up. And it might be the case that even if your operation you're doing is using just 5 microseconds and you have enough locks going up, it might pile up to milliseconds and half seconds and seconds and so on. Therefore, it's a bad thing, and it also explains things why things might take a long time. 5 minutes, I've seen it. I try my best. And you can do many things about this, and one thing is to go to read-write locks. I mean, read-write locks means you have a resource, and as long as you have only readers to this resource, there's no need for blocking other readers. That means if you know in advance, I'm just reading the value, you can increase afterwards the parallelism. I mean, you don't have to wait. You see in this situation, if you have readers, all of these readers work in parallel. They do not block each other. And not blocking means also you have no context switches. It's simply running through and is much more scalable. And only if a writer comes, you have to do something. I mean, in the writer case, it's slower than a mutex lock, but if you have caches which are mostly readers, then it's certainly a different situation. And here are some kind of timing statistics, and also for a single thread, read-write lock is better, but in the multi-thread situation, it is way faster because the throughput is getting faster because nobody has to wait for this. And also the biggest changes were actually on macOS, and which has a very good read-write lock implementation. And you see here how the number of busy locks, so from OpenSS.org site, where also the conference here runs, there is, we had there after 24 hours, several thousand locks, busy locks there. It's not a very busy machine, but it went down to single digits or nothing at the end. And you see here at the end statistics, giving you the percentage, how many write operations there were, and it typically says less than 1% of the operation are write operations. That means it's really getting much better. And there are various places where this is used. Here's a statistic which has a lot of values, and it shows how fast, relative to other operations, certain things are. I mean, I don't go to the details, but it starts, how long does it take to read a tickle variable? How long does it take to write a tickle variable? And so on. And it's also about how long does it take to get to the shared variables, in this case of the read-write logs, for example. How long does it take to read out cache values? How long does it take to access a database, and so on. And you see there, these values are, this shared variable get is 25% slower than an info exists, which is pretty cool, actually. This NSV set is similar to array set operation. And there's will space is a try operation based on the, if you have a UL, all of the components are forming a common tree, and it's very compact interpolation is also cache times two, and it is about 100 times faster than the database, this will space, a large operation, and it's 1,000 times faster than a Redis cache operation because it's integrated. Redis cache, you have to go to a different communication channel, the different process, and Redis cache is state of the art. Everybody, most of the systems out use this, but by this, this can get much better. And at the end, you see here, these large values here are 2.6 milliseconds, is a, how long does an XSLS take on the system. And I've also measured, we had yesterday some times about UDP. There's an NSUDP round trip type, just made a test yesterday, and it's just round trip type, means it sends a HTTP-like request to the server, and it gets an answer. Round trip type is about 1 millisecond, therefore it is would be somewhere in the range here. I know. I mean, there are many places there where we're using their atomic operations. It's also helping operations just to back, don't do n operations on the same mutex, lock it again and change values. It is slow, it has race conditions, but trying to also learn what this read is doing good and trying to bring this over to a tickle interface for Navi server is there, and there's a tickle interface where you can tickle updates as atomic operations, which is certainly useful. There's many things we did there which I can't explain in detail, but for example, also bandwidth management is quite important. I mean, you can specify for a different kind of request, different kind of, it's called connection pools, and you say for all of the bots out there, I just want to have one thread for this, or three threads, whatever. And you say for these threads which are coming in this pool, you want to say, limit the bandwidth. Why? I do not want to waste my bandwidth on these bots, they should wait, I don't care. But for the students, it's very important to get fast feedback. You can prioritize by this mechanism very well what's going on. Here's about UTF-8 stuff, I mean, it's more precise handling. Also concerning the discussions yesterday, you want to have good error messages in the log files and so on. And therefore, in this case, it writes here, it says you this invalid UTF-8 sequence starts here and there. And you know it is a 2-byte UTF-8 sequence. And it can help the developer to identify what's wrong. If you give him a sequence of bytes, it takes a while to understand the byte, but just identifying the kind of problem, it might be truncated, it might be a 4-byte sequence and with an invalid byte on this position, therefore it helps a little bit. Other things which are nice is something by using some kind of tickle OBJs to make the setting more friendly. For example, for timeouts, it was necessary to specify timeouts for some operations were only on second granularity, and also without a measurement, and therefore you can say here 1.5 milliseconds or whatever, and this unit implementation is there for memory sizes, kilobyte, megabyte, whatever, and for time operation. It makes the system more friendly internally. It's a number, it's normalized to something, but for externally it is much, much nicer. Maybe the last slide I want to bore you with is about HTTP2. I know it's time over, but it's the last slide I've said. It's about HTTP2. I mean, I had a master thesis there for working on integrating HTTP2 with NaviServer. And I mean, many things are different in HTTP2 and also with 3. And I mean, there are different kind of channels which are there, which can be prioritized, and the whole interaction is different, the different header information. I mean, you name it, it's quite a different protocol altogether. And I mean, what's the good news here? In summary, is there's a working version there, and what it shows, it is quite fast. I mean, quite fast means we are not comparing with some other, let's say, smalls, whatever, Python-based servers or whatever, but what is the state of the art? It's Nginx and Apache, and you see here for small files, there was many small files, that all of them are bunches of files from file patterns there, but it's significantly faster there. I mean, this is here a density diagram, and you see what are the time you're receiving there. For medium files and large files, for large files, the differences became smaller, because, I mean, at the end, the transmission time is not faster. I mean, if you transfer 20 megabytes, the connection setup is certainly faster, but for the other bytes, it's the performance improvement is you can't do anything. It's just, at the end, it's TCP. And therefore, it's you see there for this reason. But what you see is you get really quite good performance. And this is just prototype, and it's not covering all of the features of NaviServer, which should be there if we release it to the public. We have a lot of HTTP API package, and we have the HTTP client side where you can send data, you can figure out. I mean, many requests now require external services, and this is client side operations, and these are very well supported now by NaviServer. You have your own access log files. I mean, it's also important for monitoring. I mean, maybe the reason why your site is slow is some other sites, and you want to identify this quickly. And also there's work also from other sites, from OpenSSL. There's a pull request out there for integrating Qwik. Qwik means afterwards, if this is easy, hopefully easy, to do HTTP3 integration. And the plan is from the OpenSSL community to include this in OpenSSL 3.0. Time is over, but I mean, it's just giving you some kind of a summary of the things, and I'm also spamming the Complunk tickle from time to time with updates of what's new in new releases. You find this in more detail there, and you find it also on the code repository of what kind of new features. Sometimes it's a lot of details, but we have here the option to show some interesting feature and select something, but it's by far not everything. So, questions?
regarding the strategy about multiple readers and writers, I found this very interesting. Did you simulate this or?
It's real life data you see there. This is from real life sites.
Did you scale it or just tried it out in the live system and then found it?
The first thing is certainly you make some synthetic tests. Okay. And I mean, I have also tons of data for trying the different load patterns and what percentage, where does it really scale off. And there was some discussion on the W server mailing list, and if people see that writers might be slower, they say, can you really guarantee that writers are better? But you can specify it. You can at the time be created, you can say, for this cache, I want just have classic mutex lock, and this scared off the critical people. But we're using it in all time. I mean, the streaming, everything uses the thing. It's out there in okay. practice since quite a while.
Thank you, Gustav. I appreciate your detailed work. That's really great. May I ask an question which puzzles me about TLS certificate chain verification. So often with OpenSSL, we have issues with that. Can you say something about that?
If I am allowed. There's it's called a OCSP stapling protocol, and it's implemented in Navi server since, I don't know, a couple of years. I mean, I think 3 or 4 years. I mean, it's a protocol. It's not rocket science, but it's a way just for validating the protocol. I mean, what we're doing is let external OpenSSL checkers find out how you rate this site, and we always want to get the best ratings, and immediately they complained. They said, are you sure that this certificate is still valid? And using this protocol, which is not overly complicated, it was implemented. I think it was a weekend work. It was a request from a user who got a complaint during an external review of a security, and they said, can we do something about this? And after the weekend, there was the first implementation there. It always was improved over steps by learning by this, because what is if the server giving you this data is for whatever reason not reachable, and providing parameters to tune how long you will cache this value, you don't want to make for every request, and this takes afterwards some time, but it is not rocket science. OpenSSL supports it, but one has to think of what does it mean in the whole system at the end. And also there are many, let's say, OpenSSL protocol features you can enable and disable. And I know this TLS module is there on a state which is not really using the current set of things which is possible. But also the question is, how much is wanted? And it's also something which is completely open for Navi server. We do the things that we need most, and we do not try to be complete. Trying to be complete would be with OpenSSL a blocker. We would never be able to release anything useful because there's permanent things coming up, and there's not only people using the OpenSSL newest version, they're using older versions, they have a distribution with whatever, CentOS, and CentOS has this version, and other people from OpenBSD, they do not have OpenSSL, they have their own version of LibreSSL, and at some level they are compatible, but if you go to the details, there are differences. Okay, then thank you very much.